Over the last 40 years, with historical precedents dating further back, artists have been trying, often desperately, to reform, revolutionize, or reject the system by which art is made, shown, and distributed, to escape from what we call the art world, as though it were, in fact, its own universe. Of course, it has been a world unto itself, an often incestuous, class and money-bound world that tolerates artists as producers so long as someone else controls their production once it leaves the studio. Painter Rudolf Baranek introduced... I'm supposed to talk slower. I don't talk slowly. I will try. Painter Rudolf Baranek introduced the contradictions in the relationships of artists to their patrons when he said, "Art both serves and subverts the dominant class of every society. Even the most passive or subservient art is not the precise carrier of ruling class ideas, though in every way the ruling class makes an effort to make it so." I'm not going to talk much about the art. I'll just identify things that, as they go by you. This is by Anne Bray. Next, please. This is a music photograph by Diane Neumeier. Can that be sharpened up at all? I'll leave it to you for the sharpening, because I can't keep turning around. In some ways, the current division of labor makes sense. Art is work. It's hard work, though it's not labor as such. Whether or not the rest of the world recognizes it as revelation or frivolous play, above it all or below it all. The artist's work is the art work. The work of introducing the artwork to the world belongs to critics and curators. The work of selling it and supporting the artist belongs to dealers. Most artists accept this as normal, and most art workers, myself included, are complicitous in the system we complain so much about. In our current social context, artists can make a living by selling their work, taking a day job, or teaching others how to make art, even when they may have been defeated by the art system themselves. Next. This is by Edgar Heap of Birds, who is a Cheyenne Indian, about owns history. The task that is left out of this assembly line is outreach, addressing a broader spectrum of the population, bringing art into the world to play an expansive social role. Without this last step, art will always be imprisoned within mansions and ivory walls, an unheeded voice in social issues. And for many artists, that's just fine. Yet only artists are going to be able to change the art world. Nobody else cares as much about art as artists do. After all, as the Art Workers Coalition in New York made clear to the Museum of Modern Art in the 1960s, it's artists who make it all possible. Theoretically, artists could shut down the art worlds everywhere. We made brief forays into this territory in the 1960s, an art strike in New York in 1970, and of course, Paris in 1968 was a great model. But there are always scabs lined up around the block. A little dissent goes a long way in the art world. Next. That's an activist group called the Outside Agitators. That's me over there holding up Reagan's nose in my "Fuck You, Mr. President" t-shirt. This was in the 80s. Okay, that's kind of by way of an introduction. Since I'm now only an indirect participant in the art world, I'm going to talk about three moments in my own experience when I had the illusion we might succeed in changing art business as usual, or at least make a difference. My views of each period are decidedly autobiographical and should be understood as such as I talk tonight. Other participants may remember the times very differently, and that's the way history is written, of course, and that's why there are only changing multiple truths. The first of these three moments is conceptualism in the mid to late 1960s, the second is feminism in the early 1970s, and the third is what I'll call the collaborative period of the late 70s, early 80s. Some ideas raised during these moments may still be useful as analytical tools at the very least, and then I will pass the present and future up to you all for where it belongs. Next, please. This is by Robert Barry. In the mid to late 60s, for a second or two, the whole world seemed to be going our way. Conceptual art had begun to circle the art world fortresses around 1966. And by 1967, I, for one, had become seduced by the idea of a dematerialized art that would be widely distributed and free of art world machinations, as set out in an article Joan Chamber and I wrote that year, in part inspired by Saul LeWitt's writings on conceptual art with a small C, as he put it. In 1968, I juried an exhibition in Buenos Aires with Jean Clay, who was fresh off the barricades in Paris. I was trying to organize a suitcase exhibition of dematerialized art that would be taken from country to country by a chain of artists independently without the benefit of the usual institutions. When artists travel more, not to sightsee or parachute in and impose aid and ideas, but to communicate with other artists, they take with them the ambience, stimulus, and energy of the milieu in which they work, undiluted by institutional caution. Such travel is taken for granted these days, but in those days it was rare. Next, please. Clay and I were briefly introduced to the Rosario Group, then in the midst of their Tucumán Arte project, a collective work with students and workers protesting union busting and the closure of the sugar refineries. Publicity was the artist's medium, or perhaps their weapon. They created an informational circuit, as they called it, to expose the situation, attacking the official institutions of bourgeois culture in order, quote, to possess and destroy the old forms of art that reinforce the institution of individual property and the personal pleasure of the unique art object, end quote. Sounds kind of familiar today. This piece is by Eduardo Favario, who was one of the group. It's called Historical Subjects, and it was censored in Argentina in 1968, that same year. In their manifesto, these artists advocated a revolutionary art that, quote, integrates itself into total reality, destroying the idealistic separation between the work and the world as it maintains a truthful transformation of the social structures, that is to say, is a transformative art, in a sense, precisely what Alexandre was trying to do with the Paris Biennale now. This made a deep impression on me. It was the first time I'd heard artists willing to stop making their individual work until the world had changed for the better. I returned to New York wondering if artists could indeed have a hand in changing the world, not alone, never alone, but in concert with people from other fields, other places in life, a collaboration which everyone would bring her own, in which everyone would bring her own talents to the task of reinventing art. There were a lot of ideas in the air at the time, a kind of tangle of nerves and interactions between artists of very different stripes. An unconscious international energy was emerging from the raw materials of friendship, art history, interdisciplinary readings, and the fervor to visualize a new world and an art that would reflect it. The freeform branch of conceptualism with which I most identified was essentially utopian in its openness to everything extant and its opposition to the status quo. I've always been susceptible to utopian extremes because you have to have something to aim for and you might as well not settle for less than the ideal. Born of a minimalism that was contained and rejective, conceptualism embraced everything. We were obsessed with time and space, next, body and mapping, perception, measurements, boundaries, definitions, the literal and the quotidian, and with enigmatic, tedious activities that appeared simply to fill space, fill time. A kind of unexceptional lived experience that might not be available to those not living it. Next, please. I'm sorry, that was Stephen Kaltenbach's Time Capsules. Next, now. This is by the Situationists. At the same time, of course, the Situationists, as we call them, who were raising hell here in Paris. I knew very little about them at the time, but I've since realized that the spirit of conceptualism was a parallel, a rather timid parallel, to many Situationist ideas, particularly about consumerism and capitalism and the power of the idea. One of their particularly relevant slogans was, the more you consume, the less you live. What was that? Where is that in French? Do you know it in French? Le moins vous vivez. When Guy Debord said, the spectacle is capital accumulated until it becomes an image, he could have been describing conceptual art. His inspired attacks on greed and accumulation were paralleled by American conceptualist Doug Huber's statement that there were too many objects in the world already, and what was the point of making any more? Next, please. Also, at the same time, Seth Siglot was just beginning his conceptual exhibitions in which he showed artists how to bypass the established middle people, galleries, critics, and curators, and how to avoid that long wait for recognition, that gradual climb up the ladder that was and is the norm in the institutional art world. Siglot's entire process was kind of a work of art in itself. He reinvented the role of the art dealer or curator as a distributor extraordinaire. His exhibitions often took place outside of galleries and or outside of New York and or in publications that were art rather than being about art. At the same time, I aspired to rethink the role and the form of criticism. I figured that if art was anything an artist said it was, then criticism could be anything the critic said it was, too. Next, please. And also, at the same time, the newly created Art Workers Coalition started banging on the institutional doors in New York. This is a long procession of body bags. It was during an anti-war procession. We actually got hold of black body bags from the war and used them with names of the dead in the procession. The Art Workers Coalition began as a protest against the Museum of Modern Art for its lack of respect for artists' rights, spread to other institutions, and they were all attacked for lack of social conscience and ties to the ruling class and corporations who were funding the Vietnam War. We went on to confront racism and half-heartedly sexism until some women's groups got going. Among the ideas that emerged from the Art Workers Coalition were to make every museum include artists on its boards of trustees, the ruling boards of the museums. And just to make sure they didn't choose ringers, every artist in the constituency would vote for three names on the top of the list, who were found to be well-known, would be the pool from which the museums could choose. Next. This is Hans Hacke's research project on the Guggenheim trustees and how they were tied into everything that we were protesting. This was after the Guggenheim had canceled Hans's show 6 weeks before its opening. Decentralized museums or community art centers were another demand. Works from major museum collections, which hoard more art in storage than we ever see, would be doled out to communities in different cultural and mixed-income neighborhoods. The residents would choose what they wanted, and the hidden aesthetic wealth would be redistributed. Today, we still have not got anything resembling a decentralization, a democratically decentralized distribution system of artworks. The mainstream art market is and was fueled by novelty, as we all know, which in turn depends on speed and change, also known as fashion or planned obsolescence. Conceptualists were inventing ways for artists to create immaterial or invisible frames for seeing and thinking, rather than objects of delectation or connoisseurship. They gloried in speeding past the cumbersome process of making it in the art world, and they did so with mail art or rapidly edited and published books that were art in themselves, or exhibitions which existed all over the world at the same time, and other sort of small is better do-it-yourself strategies. Arte Povera, with its emphasis on production or work and often found materials, was actually called poor art, though poverty as such was never addressed. For a brief period, process art or any form intervened between minimalism and conceptualism, with perverse denials of objects in favor of an obsession with materials. Spattering, puddling, and pulverizing, it opened on next business. Opened new ways for the artist to identify kinetically with what he or she was making, including temporary performance, street works, video, and other ephemeral rebellions against what was then called the precious object syndrome. And this is by Richard Serra, part of that. Next, please. This is by James Collins. It's an introduction piece. Conceptual strategies were designed to bypass the paternalistic mainstream which infantilizes artists by making them dependent on dealers, critics, and curators, sapping their energies for the effort to enter and hang on to the status quo. In this sense, conceptual art was a kind of adolescence, often involving downward mobility. Artists have a long history of identifying, at least superficially, with the working class, but Americans don't like to think about class. artists dressed in work clothes or expensive imitations and producing a commodity accessible only to the rich differ from the real working class in a lot of ways, obviously, but also in that artists could control the distribution of their production if they had the will to do so. Next. And this is Hans Hacke's protest against the Philip Morris Corporation and their collusion with the gas they led with Senator Jesse Helms. By the 1970s, an increasing portion of the American middle class had been introduced to museums and galleries, attracted by all the 1960s media hoopla, especially around pop art, and acquiring a certain taste for art for art's sake. So you had this contradictory situation of conceptual artists trying to move down and out of their towers into the world, while their audiences moved up, like escalators passing in the night. At best, the two met in a middle ground controlled by the needs of neither group, but by those of the corporate class. Next. Obviously, conceptual art was very much a product of the political ferment of the times, which arrived belatedly in the New York art world. In the mid-1960s, a small group of artists and writers had begun organizing against the Vietnam War. This is by Nancy Spiro, Mio Baum from 1966. Even earlier, Ed Reinhardt had spoken out and demonstrated against intervention in Vietnam, but he insisted that art and politics were, art was art and politics was politics, and that when artists were activists, they were acting as citizens rather than as artists. The younger generation was trying to overcome that separation, to use its art and art skills to overthrow the cultural establishment. Next, please. Most of the effective visual anti-war imagery of the period, however, came from outside the art world, from popular political culture. The one exception was the Art Workers Coalition's And Babies poster, which you see here, about the My Lai massacre, our most successful visual venture, and one decidedly influenced by conceptualism, as was Joseph Kasuth's fake artist's membership card for entrance into the Museum of Modern Art. 50,000 copies of this collectively designed And Babies poster protesting the My Lai massacre were printed with the help of the Lithographers Union. And when the Museum of Modern Art reneged on its promises to distribute them, the Art Workers Coalition passed them out through a grassroots network of artists. We just handed a roll of posters to anybody who was going anywhere, and from Pittsburgh to Poland. And they turned up in demonstrations and exhibitions all over the world. It gave us a real sense of what we could do on our own. Next, please. This is by Doug Hubler. It's a two-part piece. You'll see the second part next. Conceptualism was subversive, though marginal, even after it was grudgingly admitted into the art historical canon, even after some of its proponents became rich and famous. When I compiled the book 6 Years, The Dematerialization of Art, annotating the history of conceptualism and its cousins, I added a rather disillusioned postface about how my hopes for a conceptual art-based revolution had been dashed. If it had seemed in 1969 that no reasonable collector would ever want a Xerox sheet, a repeatable wall drawing, a conversation, a blurry snapshot, it was clear by 1973 that the art world maw could swallow, chew up, and spit out anything that came along. For the most part, I wrote, artists have been confined to art quarters, usually by choice. However, conceptual art left a powerful legacy in its introduction of the scripto-visual mediums through which it tried to escape the art world. Did I do that? And enter the so-called real world. Can you still hear me? Its institutional critique, which happened within the art itself in its form rather than its content, remains maybe its most important legacy. Next.